Hi, everyone, and welcome back to this episode of the Reversing Mast Cell Activation Syndrome and Histamine Intolerance Summit. And I'm your co-host, Dr. Tom Moorcroft. And today we're all in for a really amazing treat. I have the great honor to speak with the mast cell master himself, Dr. Theo Theharides. And he's one of the top mast cell researchers in the entire world. He's a professor of immunology, and his research is really focused on the mechanism of selective secretion of cytokines and other pro-inflammatory molecules from mast cells. He has a broad background in immunology and has been studying the regulation of mast cells and their role in allergic and inflammatory diseases for over 30 years. He is one of the most widely published people I've ever met. He's published over 400 peer-reviewed medical journals and is cited as one of the top 5% of authors in the immunologic research field. He discovered that mast cells are inhibited by certain natural flavonoids, including and especially luteolin and tetrahydroxyluteolin, and subsequently developed a well-known mast cell blocking supplement, NeuroProtect. So I am just so honored to have an opportunity to talk with you, Dr. Theo, and welcome to the summit.
Well, thank you very much for the invite. I'm delighted, especially since I'll be talking hopefully about a subject that I'm absolutely passionate about.
I'm very interested. I was remarking with you as we were, you know, getting started before we hit record that, you know, I just remember back in an ILADS conference, you know, we're all studying Lyme, and it was like the first time I'd really gotten exposed to your work. And it really changed the way I looked at my patients with chronic illness. So I'm really excited to be able to share some of that with our listeners today as we talk about mast cells and neuroinflammation. So what got you interested in mast cells of all things? And what's its journey been like?
It's a very interesting story. Back in 1972, a long time ago, in the summer, I had just graduated from Yale. And I had spent a few weeks at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where a very well-known duel was going on between two professors. That was evidently an annual event. And in that particular time, the duel were between Professor Padoer, who was a histopathologist, Jacques Padoer, Canadian, and Sam Zeifter, who was a biochemist. And they chose to hash out a topic, which was mast cells. And I was like, wow. And the biochemist, Sam Zeifter, felt that it was an incredible cell because it either contains and or can make as many as 100 different biologically active mediators. And Jacques Padoer felt that it was actually a useless cell because he had done a very important experiment. He had injected in the peritoneal cavity of rats gold particles, and the mast cell is notorious about taking things from the outside and storing them in their granules. So the mast cells took up the gold, and then he sacrificed the animals over time until old age, and the gold was still there. So therefore, he said, under laboratory normal circumstances, the mast cells don't degranulate, because if they had, the gold would have been released, the macrophages would have removed it. So these were the two extremes. At that time, I was starting my PhD thesis at Yale. I was undergraduate, doctorate in pharmacology, and my medical school was at Yale. Mm-hmm. And I was working between two very strong-minded but very good friends, professors. So one was Bill Douglas, who was a neuroanatomist, and Paul Gringard, who was mostly sort of a biochemist. And Paul Gringer had gotten the Nobel Prize, actually, in physiology and medicine a few years into my PhD. And we were looking for a good secretory cell to study. So Bill Douglas was very interested in the pituitary gland. Paul Gringer was interested in neurons, specifically in general. And they told me, go find a good cell. And I recall the discussion at Albert Einstein, and I said, how about the mast cell? Here's a cell that has 1,000 secretory granules. Each secretory granule stores about 50 or so molecules that we know, and then when it's triggered, it makes another 50 or so. And it is not only triggered by allergens. So I said, what better secretory cell to study than the mast cell? And I did all my PhD thesis on the mast cell, between 72 and 78, so to speak, and I've been hooked ever since.
Ever since. Wow, that's kind of cool. Like
so.
The mast cells, like it's interesting because I was thinking as you're talking about that in medical school, it's sort of like the mast cell lets out histamine and it's a white cell and that's kind of like all you need to know. And that's
Unfortunately, this is pretty much what it is still being taught, even at the National Institute of Health, where they ought to know better than that. And here's a little story as well. The mast cell was discovered by Paul Ehrlich in 1887. It was part of his doctoral thesis. But at about the same time, in 1901, there was an experiment that was being conducted out of the Oceanographic Museum at the Principality of Monaco by two French scientists, Portier and Richer. And the experiment was they took jellyfish tentacles, because jellyfish men of war were rampant at that time. They ground them up, they gave them to dogs, they injected the dogs, and they were pretty sure the dogs would be protected from subsequent stings. So they had a term ready for it. They were going to call it prophylaxis. However, when they immunized the dogs and they re-exposed them to the jellyfish, they dropped the blood pressure, the bronchi constricted, they went into acute anaphylaxis and they died. So they called it anaphylaxis. So the term anaphylaxis and mast cells were discovered at about the same time, 2 years apart, but they were never connected until 1947, when histamine was discovered in mast cells. So hundreds of years went by, but we realized, and now since 1947, we're still taking the same idea that histamine is the main problem in all of these conditions, which is not.
It's just like so remarkable, because it's like literally, it's like I'm like, everything I've been taught is just, that's really what it is. So what else is in, and you know, anaphylaxis is obviously a thing that all of us learn in medical school, and a lot of people know about bee stings or shrimp, and it's a scary thing. But so what else is going on with the mast cell and in our health? Like, what are the things that we need to know about it to start to learn, to kind of set the record straight, if you will, about what they're doing?
So first of all, we've got to realize that one does not have to be allergic in order for the mast cells to fire. So they're individuals. And as you know, in medicine, if we don't know something, we call it idiopathic. So there's idiopathic anaphylaxis. Out of the blue, someone responds. And one of the key molecules in wasp venom is called mastoparan. And you're not allergic to mastoparan. Mastoparan will trigger the mast cells in its own right. So we have to stop thinking of the mast cells responding only to allergens, which is a big deal. I'm not trying to minimize that.
Oh, right.
But they can respond to molecules released under stress, molecules released from, you know, viruses, from bacteria, fungi, mycotoxins can trigger the mast cells. And probably the most important message for today, as far as I'm concerned, is that the mast cell is very dynamic. It's not just a static cell, you trigger it, it will release something, and that's the end of it. It changes as you go along. So mast cells are very different in the skin, in the gut, in your mouth, and if we have time to talk about in the brain. And when the mast cells are triggered, their reactivity to other stimuli changes enormously. And I'm sure you and other colleagues, certainly I, have had numerous patients who had a little kind of allergic diathesis. I prefer sometimes atopic diathesis, because that's a little broader than just strict allergy. And then they undergo major surgery, trauma, God forbid someone dies in the family, and now they respond to everything under the sun. So the mast cells can change the reactivity, and we have to be very cognizant of that, because if we think we're going to stop the mast cell at one point in time, we're just missing the dynamics of what is happening, not only with the mast cell, but in the whole body.
So what's leading to that? I mean, it's like, because I mean, you know, we talk a lot about the hyper responsiveness, almost like the mast cell being a sentinel to protect us, but then it's on guard all the time rather than only certain times. But like, what is leading to this, and what is that pathway that we need to be looking at?
Well, that's easier said than done. let me start historically.
Right.
The mast cell has been identified in species over 400 million years. So all the way from mollusks to octopi to zebrafish, has tons of mast cells, to invertebrates, vertebrates, and of course, you know, humans. So obviously the mast cell played a role at some point. And I'm sure it's still pleasurable now. That is not necessarily detrimental. Maybe go back to millions of years ago. So those invertebrates, or you know, small vertebrates, etc., did not necessarily have developed immune, nervous, hormonal systems. So the mast cell, both other colleagues and I believe, played a role because it makes, synthesizes, and releases all such molecules. It makes and it responds to endorphins. It makes and responds to catecholamines. It makes and responds to sex hormones, so forth and so on. And as we developed, other systems took over, and the mast cell sort of maybe remained a sentinel cell for maybe poisons, maybe toxins, maybe parasites going up in our behind, etc. And as we've evolved even more, and then we had antibiotics, you know, we were purified by being inside homes with, you know, air conditionings and vacuum cleaners and whatever, the mast cell probably didn't have that much to do with protecting us, but it was still there as the canary in the mine for things that might still be dangerous. And it probably does that in some individuals more than others for genetic reasons as well. However, when it comes to stimulation, we know that even stimulation with an allergen, which is through immunoglobulin E, can actually talk to other receptors on the surface. And a good example of that, jumping way ahead, is the drug Xolair that neutralizes circulating IgE, but it has been shown with publications that it is helpful in vibration urticaria, in pressure urticaria. There's no IgE involved there. So that by definition means that when you strip the IgE from the surface, this is what Xolair does, or other similar drugs, then the body doesn't see Ig anymore. And what do the cells normally do? They interiorize the receptors. I don't need that many receptors anymore. There's no Ig around.
Right.
And I think that as the cell does that, other receptors that might be linked covalently might also be drawn and internalized and destroyed. And vice versa. If you stimulate something too much, maybe other receptors get expressed, and then now you have, you know, core activity. So I just submitted 2 weeks ago an invited review on mast cell activation. And one of the tables shows that the mast cell expresses about 50 different receptors on the surface, other than the receptor for IgE. So obviously the receptors are there, they're there for some reason. And even though there are also some inhibitory receptors, no one has ever found natural or synthetic molecules to stimulate the inhibitory receptors to shut the mast cell down. So we're still basically in the dark.
Interesting.
So answering more precisely your question, I don't think there's just one pathway that we might address to inhibit the mast cells. But I tend to think, how can we actually block the last steps of the mast cell activation? So you have 50 receptors. Mm-hmm. You know, different stimuli, they'll go through various pathways. Eventually, they have to release something. So if we can block that final release step, that might be our best bet to shut the mast cell down.
Right. And it's kind of like the Holy Grail, it seems like, because, I mean, you know, it's almost, I'm thinking as you're talking, this is one of the things a lot of us are just like, let's block histamine. And it doesn't always seem to work that easily.
Not at all. Besides, now you might have put your finger to something very important. We always say histamine is in the secretory granules. There are about 1,000 of them per cell. Okay? Presumably, in those granules, we also have enzymes like tryptase and chymase and carboxypeptidase, just to give you some. Mm-hmm. We always thought that all of these are released together, and that doesn't seem to be true at all. We have many cases in mast cell activation where histamine is released, but tryptase is not released. And very recently, over the last few months, there are three publications, independent publications, that in individuals that suffered from COVID-19, chymase was elevated in the blood, but not histamine and not tryptase. So how on earth is then chymase being released from the same granules without tryptase and histamine, since we always said this is degranulation? And a paper that was just published this week, and maybe we'll return to this if we talk about COVID, was quite fascinating because it showed convincingly that the spike protein binds to chymase, and the two together can damage the blood-brain barrier. Okay, this was just published. So the whole idea of what the mast cells do in certain conditions, including COVID-19, is really changing rapidly.
Man, this is like opening Pandora's box, right? I mean, because one of the points I want to highlight is like testing for folks, like and COVID is so critical, and we need to talk about it as well as neuroinflammation. And with testing, a lot of times, like I just remember as you're speaking, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's like a lot of us will run like a tryptase and stuff to verify it's anaphylaxis or whatever, or earlier, you know, phase of anaphylaxis. So, but a lot of people, I think, get frustrated that they say I have mast cell activation syndrome and our testing is kind of miserable for it. But it's almost sounding like the symptoms that you can get from mast cell activation may not just always be histamine related.
Not at all. Back in 2015, two colleagues of mine, Jem Akin and Peter Valente, and I wrote a review in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I was grateful to the journal, I still am, because the title was Mast Cells, Mastocytosis, and Related Disorders. So It opened up the door to the possibility other molecules are being released. And in fact, one of the diagrams that we have in that journal shows the mast cell in the middle, and depending what the trigger, the outcome is different, and it can affect every organ of the body. And I want to stress that paper because many colleagues might not know, there was a supplemental file to that paper.
Okay.
So if you visit New England Journal of Medicine, I was the first author, so you can easily pick it up. There was a supplemental file that has never existed before and has not existed since, showing a human mast cell degranulating in real time. So I have a mast cell in three dimensions between two cover slips, perfusing it with a neuropeptide, and within 5 seconds, it goes boop, 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 and it degranulates. Okay? So once you see that, you know how dynamic and powerful the cell is, and we're not talking about histamine. So I would urge you, go back to the journal and go to the supplemental file, and you will be really impressed. And I'm not saying this because I took the video. It's so powerful to see how dynamic, and you see thousands of granules spitting their content out. That's what happens in anaphylaxis, but not necessarily during infections, etc., when the cell releases molecules without undergoing degranulation, without tryptase, without histamine. So in this last review that I submitted, hopefully will be accepted, I have a list of what I propose should be potential markers of mast cell activation beyond histamine and tryptase.
Right. I'm sure all of us are going to be so interested in seeing this and checking it. I mean, are there particular things that we should be kind of maybe considering clinically to start looking at, or...
Well, we should. So first of all, I mean, it's obviously important to measure tryptase, because if tryptase is high, it's telling us something. So either you've got, you know, mastocytosis, or you've got this genetic condition, you know, alpha hypertryptosemia, which is also very confusing, because these patients have a lot of symptoms in many organs. And yet in alpha hypertryptosemia, it is the alpha tryptase monomers that are released and they're inactive, while in the granules it is the beta tryptase tetramer that becomes active when it's released. So it's beyond me how an inactive monomer can still cause symptoms in about five different organs, you know. So we still don't know what it means, and of course we don't have any drug to block tryptase, period, anyhow. So having said that, to the extent possible, it is important to measure at least the prostaglandin, leukotriene, and histamine metabolite in the urine, because that is telling us that the mast cells are spitting out other mediators than just tryptase. Mm-hmm. And it used to be that we need only 24-hour urine to measure that. Now it suffices, at least at the Mayo Clinic, to give them first morning void, but it has to be cold. If it comes up to room temperature, they're gone. So you're going to get negative results. And then finally, there were four papers. One was published from my group, the other from Dr. Metcalf at NIH, the other from Dr. Escribano in Spain, showing that interleukin 6 levels reflected disease activity better than tryptase or histamine. And of course, my colleagues say, you know, we can't really measure IL-6 because IL-6 can be released in other inflammatory diseases, of course. But if there's no other comorbidity, why not measure it? You know, if someone has inflammatory bowel disease, well, it might be coming from the bowel, et cetera. And a paper was published recently confirming what we had also published extensively, that vascular endothelial growth factor is actually increased both in mastocytosis and mast cell activation patients. And I always measure that because it tells me whether the vasculature is actually leaky, in which case it will promote inflammation, etc. Finally, and I'm trying very hard to come up with a way to measure platelet activating factor, PAF. PAF has been known for many years, but it is impossibly difficult to measure in a clinical laboratory. However, there have been very good papers, including a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine from Dr. Vadas in Canada, that showed that levels of PAF in the blood were more reflective of severity of anaphylaxis than either histamine or tryptase. But because we cannot measure it, we ignore it. However, even if we cannot measure it, there are ways to block PAF, and that should be actually a regular component of treatment of mast cell activation diseases moving forward. Again, if we have time, I'll get back to this.
Yeah, I think that maybe the way we can kind of structure flowing through the rest is because I think that blocking PAF is like that. I mean, these are the things that we need to know because, as you mentioned earlier, there's different triggers, stress, viruses, and I'd love for you to touch on things because a lot of our patients that we're talking with are exposed to mycotoxins, candida maybe even. A lot of people have tick-borne illness or even community-acquired pneumonia, bugs that are persistent. And then obviously, as you mentioned, we should maybe talk a little stress and dovetail right into COVID if you want to kind of like play with that a little bit because I think that this is what our audience is, these are some of the things our audience is experiencing and certainly obviously knowing what to do after COVID and how COVID impacts mast cells and then how to block some of this is certainly totally high yield stuff here.
Sure.
It's super exciting. This is like, I feel like kid on Christmas right now. I mean, such great information.
Well, let me, before we get into, you know, COVID and the like, let me just first say that the terminology used is very confusing, still very confusing. Mm-hmm. So let me just start out by saying, generally separate mast cell diseases into the primary, and as an example would be either systemic mastocytosis or cutaneous mastocytosis. Mm-hmm. So by definition, you have a lot more mast cells. Then you have the secondary, and in most cases of the primary, the mast cells are also activated. So we should reserve the word activation for many different settings, not just mast cell activation syndrome, to which I will return. Mm-hmm. So whether you have systemic mastocytosis, in probably 100% of the people, the mast cells are activated by X, Y, and Z. In cutaneous mastocytosis, the mast cells are not as activated as in systemic, but they're more activated if you rub, you know, the lesions, et cetera, you know, heat. So that takes us to the secondary, which might be allergic rhinitis, allergic, you know, pruritus. It might be what we call pressure urticaria or physical urticarias. And then the third category is idiopathic. So you've got idiopathic anaphylaxis, idiopathic angioedema, idiopathic whatever. And now you have a category mast cell activation syndrome, which according to my colleagues, it has to have tryptase elevation within 48 hours of an episode, which is almost impossible to measure unless you have an indwelling catheter. And most laboratories will not even measure it. Most emergency rooms don't know what it is, let alone measure it. And then you have the category of mast cell activation, comma, unspecified, and that has its own diagnostic code. So we don't have to necessarily be going crazy. Is this really mast cell activation syndrome? Because if it doesn't have tryptase, let's just call it mast cell activation unspecified. It still has a diagnostic code. You can still do a whole bunch of testing on it, et cetera. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, but most everybody talks about the MCAS, the syndrome. And I think that just derails us from thinking that mast cells can be activated in many, many other conditions. I'll give you an example unrelated to all of this. In solid tumors, whether it's breast, pancreatic, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, we have accumulation of mast cells. No one knows why. We always thought that they were being accumulated to kill the tumor. And yet the tumor cells are smarter than us. They prevent the mast cell from degranulating. I've never seen degranulate mast cells around tumors, yet they stimulate the mast cells to release VEGF and other angiopoietins, that allows neovascularization, growth of the cancer, metastasis. So the cancer cell can do what I have not been able to do in 40 years, can tell the mast cell what to do to its advantage. If I could tell the mast cell what to do, I can tell the mast cell, don't release angiogenic factors, release tumor necrosis factor and kill the tumor cells. And I don't know how to do it. Okay? So that's why the mast cell is fascinating. I mean, in my mind, it's like a microcosm of pharmacology circulating in the body. If I could put a microchip on the mast cell and tell it what to release in what part of the body, I have the best treatment ever for many conditions.
For
and
real.
Maybe 100 years from now, that's exactly what we'll be having. So coming back now, what is the original approach for treatment? And I will leave the good stuff for the end. once you identify that there is activation of mast cells, you have a clinical history, you give them some antihistamines, a little better, you know something is brewing. And if you actually scratch their underarm and you get dermatographia, then you know the mast cells are activated just by pressure, which means that they're ready to fire. No allergens involved. So I always do this scratch test because if they're positive, that is telling me that antihistamines probably are not going to be enough to take care of these patients, because the mast cell responded to pressure and not necessarily to an allergen. So what do? We try some antihistamines. Three things to know about antihistamines that we usually don't think about. Number one, they're not all the same. Number two, about 15% of the people get wired, even though we're supposed to be sedating to some extent. So a lot of people just don't tolerate them. There you go. Okay. So it's very hard to tell a patient, oh, take, you know, X, it's good for you. And the patient is, you know, pulling their hair because they're now wired. Number three, there are some antihistamines that have additional properties. I'll give you an example, hydroxyzin or Atarax. It's slightly sedating and it's slightly anti-anxiety. Many times we give them to children that have enuresis at night. They might have had a very difficult day. I find it very useful to give it at night, for instance. It puts you in a deep sleep. So people, you know, before they go to Ambien or, you know, whatever, for, you know, not being able to sleep, I'll give them a little Atarax. So then you have antihistamines, one of which I'll mention, and I'll return to it, which is rupatadine. Rupatadine has existed in Europe for 20 years, in Canada for 3 years, still not in the United States. But it's as good an antihistamine as any. It partially blocks mast cells, and it was designed to be a PAF inhibitor. So you get three birds with one stone. And by the way, anybody can get Rupal from Canada with a US prescription through a Canadian online pharmacy. You don't have to compound it. Lots of patients, you know, physicians get it from Canada. I'll return to this when it comes to COVID as well. Okay. So then what do you do after that? Well, you try to block the mast cells. And, you know, most everybody reads about cromolyn blocking the mast cells. I published on cromolyn as an undergraduate at Yale in 1971. It worked perfectly in rats. It was very bad in mice. And it really doesn't block human mast cells. Okay, it just doesn't.
Interesting.
It became word of mouth that it's a good blocker because they called it mast cell blocker. It gets absorbed less than 5% from the gut. Does it inhibit anything? Yes, it inhibits histamine release, maybe about 20%, mostly in the gut. It doesn't do anything else. And the body gets used to it very quickly. We call that tachyphylaxis. So we start with 100 milligrams, you know, a vial a day. Then it becomes, before you know it, about 3 months, it's 400 milligrams four times a day. And by that time, you have about 15% of explosive diarrhea. So it's not an easy drug, and it's very expensive as well. So don't get me wrong. If someone has GI symptoms and they take it and do well, all power to their elbow. And I find nasal chrome quite useful. So nasal chrome is nasal spray. So I find it for allergic rhinitis quite useful, but not the oral cromolyn. But anyhow, some colleagues will try cromolyn because it's available. Then what do? Well, you think maybe leukotrienes are involved. We know leukotrienes are extremely bronchoconstrictive. That's why we have singular. But because we don't know what to do, we might say, okay, nothing else is helping. Let's put you on 10 milligram singular and hope for the best. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It really doesn't have that many side effects. I'm leaving the polyphenols out. I'm talking about the sort of the straightforward, you know, colleague who doesn't think outside the box. If someone has tremendous itching, they might think about Zoller. Okay. And that's about it in terms of what they will do. Some will go crazy and they'll say, oh, I'll put someone on Plaquenil. God forbid. Okay? So, but they do. Okay, they do. You might also put someone on more exotic tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Mm-hmm. Those are work well for mastocytosis, but they do not block mast cell activation. So, right. You know, for someone that doesn't have mastocytosis, they're not going to work. So that takes me back now to almost 40 years ago when I was studying cromolyn. And if you think of cromolyn, it's a butterfly with two wings. And I did one of the first searches on molecular mimicry back then. And what do you know? The basic structure of a polyphenolic compound is almost identical to one of the wings of the butterfly. So it was very nice. Similar to cromolyn. And that's what got me interested in flavonoids to begin with. In addition to the fact that probably the guru on flavonoids was Dr. Middleton, who unfortunately died many years ago. And his colleague had called me up about 1998 or so. And he said that he had left in his will that I actually take his work on flavonoids and write a review. And I was really taken and honored.
Wow.
So we published a review in Pharmacological Reviews in 2000 about flavonoids. That's become classic, basically, in terms of citations. Mm-hmm. So the flavonoids are very antioxidant. They're anti-inflammatory, and they can block mast cells. But there are 3,000 of them in nature, and all of them are not the same, and all of them don't do the same, and some are bad, actually. So when we talk later about polyphenolic compounds, I have to actually differentiate and say why we have to be very careful about what we choose and how we give it. Taking me back, we were amazed over the years that many patients with mast cell or allergic-like problems would get worse when they were stressed. I mean, that was well known. And of course, what did we used to hear? Or it's all in your head. Go and see a shrink.
Right. Super tentorial.
We were the first that published that the main hormone released under stress, corticotropin releasing hormone or CRH, it's released outside the brain and it stimulates the mast cells to release molecules without histamine and tryptase and changes the reactivity of the mast cells to allergens as well. So there's no question that stress via CRH can actually do a job on the mast cells.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, in treating or attempting to treat any of the patients we're talking about, reducing stress in any way possible is very important in my mind. If they continue to swim in stress, no matter what we do, they'll continue to have problems. So I had one patient from Brussels who used to trade diamonds in the upper parts of Russia. And he would come back and you will be covered with eczema and all kind of other problems. And I said, well, what do you do when you go up there? Well, you know, I've got some bags with diamonds and, you know, bags with dollars and a couple of people with Kalashnikovs. And I don't know if I'll come back alive. I said, you're crazy. I mean, you're swimming in stress. So I said, look, he was also Greek American. I mean, Belgian American. Belgian Greek. So I said, just go to a Greek island, you know, for a couple of years and forget trading diamonds.
Bit, right?
Chill out. Okay. and he did phenomenally well. I mean, you know, it's obviously anecdotal, but it was true. And I had received actually 5 US patents on how to block CRH as it relates to muscle related diseases, but now I was interested in bringing them, as the lawyers say, reducing it to practice. So 70 years have gone by and the patents are gone. And we still don't have any way of blocking. These were CRH receptor antagonists for such kind of diseases. So to finish this part, from the very beginning, I was amazed by the fact that the median eminence, the little stalk that connects the hypothalamus mm-hmm. to the pituitary, has as many mast cells per unit volume as our skin. Yet the brain doesn't get allergic reactions. So what do they do? Immunoglobulin E cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. Unless it becomes, you know, leaky.
Compromise.
So they must be doing something. And of course, CRH is right there. Hypothalamus mm-hmm. makes CRH in addition to other molecules. So it became apparent that the mast cells may be contributing to sort of neuropsychiatric symptoms, both indirectly by releasing things outside the brain that might cross the blood-brain barrier, as well as by being activated inside the brain. But to this day, no one really has focused on mast cells in the brain, in spite of, you know, numerous publications by myself and other colleagues. So let me stop and let you ask.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think it's phenomenal. I could listen to this all day because there's so many pieces that are kind of bringing together some of the questions we have. And I know that we don't have maybe all the answers like you just alluded to, but I feel like it gives me comfort that, and hopefully to our the any of the patients who are experiencing these symptoms watching, that we're starting to understand why you're reacting the way you're reacting. And we may not have all the answers yet, but we've got science is leading us in that direction. And I love the fact that stress, like we keep saying, everybody's, oh, de-stress, and that's all nice, right? But for us to be able to understand there's a scientific basis.
Correct.
And we know that de-stressing will for sure help balance out our mast cell, you know, response. That's a lot of hope, because you have so much control. You have more control over stress, it sounds like, than our supplements or our medications have over your mast cells.
Correct. We published two separate papers, and another colleague published a third paper. In one instance, we had a patient with cutaneous mastocytosis that after a very stressful event, she was covered. She went from a few lesions to hundreds of lesions. And we measured CRH in the blood, and it was off the roof. We had another patient that we published who had systemic mastocytosis, notoriously will get worse under stress. And in that instance, not only we measured and we showed CRH was high in the blood, but we took her biopsies that were done in Michigan, and we restained the biopsies where there were clusters of mast cells with a fluorescent antibody to a CRH receptor, and the mast cells lit up like light bulbs. So we know what is happening. It's just that we don't have a way of blocking the release of CRH or the action of CRH as of yet. But there are ways to reduce stress that might not necessarily require, you know, benzodiazepines and other things. Again, if we have time, we can get into that.
Yeah, I think there's we definitely have some. It's great to hear this, because some of the other speakers on the summit talk about like limbic stuff and stress reduction too. So, but we're seeing the science of it. One of the things that I really would love to hear about too is, you had mentioned COVID, and I'm sure we've talked about it several times here as one of the things that might have a unique relationship with mast cells. And I would want to make sure we put that in and then give you a chance to talk about polyphenols and how to properly utilize them.
Well, just as COVID started, I published a couple of papers 2.5 years ago, immediately saying that most of the action, at least at that time, appeared to be in the lungs. We know mast cells are in the lungs. We know mast cells contain lots of cytokines, and pretty much patients were dying because what was called cytokine storm. Mm-hmm. Yet, the ability of the virus to bind to its key receptor, which is angiotensin converting enzyme 2, ACE2 receptor, they had nothing to do with cytokines. The ACE2 receptor is important for the virus to get into the nucleus and multiply. So where were the cytokines coming from? So that was question number one. Mm-hmm. Question number two was, can we actually block the mast cells in the lung? And of course, if one could actually squeeze something in the nose or have them inhale it, that would be tremendous. But no one ever did that, and they still haven't done it. Number three, can we measure anything that comes out of the mast cells in the blood to see if, in fact, there is some outcome, or through bronchoscopy in, bronchoalveolar lavage fluid? So while I was writing this reviews, and they were published in different journals, one paper came out from France showing that in the alveolar septa of patients that had died and they did pathology, the mast cells were activated. They didn't measure what, but it was the first paper. Mm-hmm. And a second paper came out showing that chymase was high, but not tryptase. Then a third paper came out a few months ago showing that when they infected mice with COVID, SARS-CoV-2 protein, not COVID, the mast cells in the lungs got activated, but they only released chymase. And when they went to patients and they looked at asymptomatic, symptomatic, and severe patients, chymase was actually tracking with the severity of the disease. Again, no tryptase, no histamine. So there was clear evidence that the mast cells were being activated, although it threw us for a loop as to why molecules that are in the same granules are not released together. We still don't know the answer to that. At the same time, a paper was published that very few people paid attention to, and that was actually published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where they looked at 81 countries. They looked at the level of pollen and the incidence of COVID, and they tracked together. The more pollen, the more COVID. And they said that maybe because you breathe the virus And if you have an allergic response in the nose because of the allergen, et cetera, the type of immunity shifts and doesn't protect against the virus. To me, it was an obvious indication that if the muscles are activated there, maybe they were making things more likely to occur vis-a-vis COVID infection, since it goes through the nose.
Did that right.
And finally, we did some experiments, which since only one paper recently actually published, because we didn't have time to publish because they shut our lab down, but we showed that the spike protein, recombinant spike protein, can stimulate the mast cells. So you didn't eat the whole virus, just the spike protein. And at the same time, because we were very interested about what happens in the brain, brain fog, long COVID, et cetera, we also took human cultured microglia, which, as you know, are the defenders of the brain. And the spike protein recombinant also stimulated the microglia. And two papers now have been published showing the same thing. So you don't necessarily need the whole virus, which to some extent worried me, because if the spike protein can cross the blood-brain barrier or damage the blood-brain barrier, then it can get in and set up sort of a local perivascular inflammation. And that's exactly what has been shown in pathology of patients who died. There's perivascular inflammation. And I wrote a paper in molecular neurobiology about a year ago, less than a year ago. And the question was, could the spike protein be responsible for COVID-19 neurologic symptoms? And we actually showed in a diagram, whether you have microglia or mast cells, how basically the spike protein can do that. And we proposed that it might be through toll-like receptors that respond to viruses, fungi, and bacteria. And since then, three papers have been published, one in Nature, showing that the spike protein can stimulate toll-like receptors, unrelated to its main receptor for invasion, which is ACE2. So for about 2 years, we were missing the boat, basically, focusing on ACE2. Well, the mast cell expresses all toll-like receptors, 1 through 9. You know, 4 is for LPS, 2 is for fungi, et cetera. So with that in mind, immediately I said, can we block the mast cells by using at least whatever we have available? And what was available was literally quercetin and luteolin. In terms of inhibiting the mast cells. Both we and others have published on that. Immediately, a Canadian group did a clinical study on quercetin, and it showed that it could actually reduce symptoms. Another study was done in India with very few patients, showing that quercetin could, again, inhibit the symptoms to some extent. They were not focusing on mast cells necessarily. Right. But the difficulty is that quercetin is absorbed less than 10% from the gut, and so is luteolin. That's why we focused on how to increase absorption of both quercetin and luteolin. So we put both quercetin and luteolin together in two preparations. One is called NeuroProtect. It's a smaller capsule because some individuals cannot swallow bigger capsules. And the other is called FibroProtect. That is almost double the amount of both quercetin and luteolin. Again, in olive pomace oil to increase absorption. Since then, we have two clinical studies ongoing. One is actually about to start in the Miami VA long COVID clinic, and one is going on in Greece. And we published one paper, which was literally changed our thinking. This was a lady well-known from a big city in Florida. 2 years ago, went down with COVID. She had all the symptoms you can imagine. She was given everything that was available at the time, including, you know, convalescent serum and, you know, azithromycin and dexamethasone, you know, the works.
Everything, yeah.
And her lungs basically were so damaged that she was put on double lung transplant list, and she was living on 10 liters oxygen.
Okay. Holy cow.
So what we decided, I was asked to consult through a friend, and her primary physicians went along, God bless them. So we put them actually on FibroProtect, you know, 4 of those a day. We put her on another supplement called Brain Gain that is much more helpful if you have brain fog, not necessarily symptoms all over the place. We put her on Rupal from Canada because, as I said earlier, it blocks also PAF, and there are independent papers that PAF is involved in COVID, including two papers we wrote. And then we put her also on an old drug that we don't think about anymore, Cytotec. So Cytotec is a prostaglandin E, you know, agonist. We used to give it to protect the stomach of old-timers taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, but it's anti-fibrotic. And in this patient, the lungs were actually fibrosing. 100 micrograms per day, not milligrams, don't make a mistake. And then because she was not exchanging enough oxygen, we put her actually on erythropoietin injections, sub-Q, 3 times a week. In 3 months, her lungs looked so perfect, she was taken off the transplant list and she's back to low practice. Yeah? Now, that doesn't mean to say that every patient, you know, will have such amazing, turnaround, but it points to the fact that we have ways to address aspects of COVID. And what is really most important for the brain, the polyphenolic compounds are called phenolic because they had hydroxyl groups attached to the benzene rings. And that's called a phenolic ring. The more hydroxyl groups you have, the more phenolic you are, the more antioxidant you are, but the less anti-inflammatory you are. And the more phenolic groups, the less likely you'll get into the brain. That's why we focused on luteolin, because unlike quercetin, which has 5 hydroxyl groups, luteolin has 4, and it's likely to get into the brain. So the quercetin part of the neuroprotect and the fibroprotect catches the mast cells outside the brain, and it acts like a decoy because it gets metabolized to allow luteolin to escape and get into the brain.
I love it because, like, you know, it's so funny. It's that so many of the folks speaking with us here, and obviously yourself and myself, are scientists. And yet we're still looking at sort of functional medicine and quote-unquote alternative. And I think that this is, like, for me, like, so much hope, because we're using real science to get real results, and we understand that maybe we need, you know, one of these medications, or maybe we need a supplement, and to do that. So one of the things that we had talked about that I think is really important is when you talk about the polyphenols, I mean, do you have particular tips for the public to kind of navigate? Because, like, what you just said is there's certain ones we should and we shouldn't use, and then there's also dosing considerations.
So number one, please try to find out the source, the purity, and the amount. No one mandates that. The FDA does not mandate that. So many supplements, they'll say proprietary blend, and they will not tell you what they have.
Right.
In fact, many of them do that. That's number one. Number two, the polyphenolic compounds, all of them are yellow. The more hydroxyl groups you have, the more color you have. So if you open up, whether it's a capsule or a pill, and it's not yellow, there's no quercetin there. There's no luteolin there. Okay, so that's kind of a quick way to find out if someone is pulling your leg. Then the source is very important. And again, supplements don't tell you the source. As you will see in the supplements I helped develop, they'll say in parentheses with Latin, because that's how it's supposed to be by the FDA, what it is.
Right.
The reason is because the cheapest source of quercetin and some of these flavonoids is actually peanut shells. But no one is telling you it's from peanuts. So if you're allergic to peanuts,
and
well,
you're taking
you know
peanuts.
What will happen. The next cheaper source is fava beans. But about 20% of Mediterranean extraction people like myself, you know, Greeks, Italians, you know, Jewish, Northern Africans, they lack G6PD. If you lack G6PD and eat fava beans, you get hemolytic anemia. Go chase your tail now. You know, you're going to be running to a hematologist while all of a sudden your cells are going to pieces. And the third, which is also very important, is the most polyphenolic something is, the more likely about 20% of the people to get hyper on it. These are people that have phenol intolerance. And we know why, because the enzymes that break down phenols, they might have mutations. So I always ask for, you know, gene mutations for about 6 different enzymes, because they will direct me not only about supplements, but about drugs, what to give them, how much to give them. Mm-hmm. As you know, we separate people in fast metabolizers and slow metabolizers. So if someone is slow metabolizer, 1 gram of quercetin might be 5 grams for them. And, you know, it might cause problems. So try to find out source, purity, and amount.
Okay.
The second is that too much of something is not necessarily good. So I'll give you the example that I gave you before we started. Some of my colleagues will say, well, you know, flavonoids are absorbed less than 10%. Let's give them 2 grams. That means it will absorb 200 milligrams. 1,800 milligrams will stay in the gut. They will shut down your bioflora, and it will cause dysbiosis. And then you start chasing your tail as to how do I fix dysbiosis. That's why we mix them up with olive pomace oil. And what is olive pomace oil? If you take the olive oil, you're left with the pit and a little bit of the shell of the olive. If you squeeze that, you get a thicker oil. And in Greece, we use it as a salad dressing. But it is cheaper than olive oil in trying to keep actually the cost down. And it's not like you can take any pomace oil, because as you know, the oleic acid content of either the olive oil or the olive pomace oil is what causes you to have heartburn. You know, which if the oleic acid is too much, you kind of get a heartburn. So the typical olive oil that you buy, you know, anywhere is actually 1 to 2% oleic acid. The olive pomace oil we use is 0.1%, so 10 times less, to make sure that we don't run into that problem. And the third problem to watch out, which maybe I should have said earlier, is that soy flavonoids. Many times you see soy bioflavonoids, soy flavonoids. Soy flavonoids are estrogenic. So if, God forbid, a lady has, you know, ovarian cancer, you know, breast cancer, those would be a no-no, absolutely no-no. So again, not everything is the same, unfortunately. And at the end of the day, duration of time is more important than the amount. I always, especially when we don't know who the patients are, sometimes they'll just order something and then you don't have the chance to talk to them. I always say start with one and slowly increase to the extent tolerated. And then, of course, you know, if someone were to come to you, it would be important, do they have any endocrine problems? Do they have thyroid disease? Because at 2 grams a day, quercetin will shut down thyroxine production. But if you have someone who is hyperthyroid, then it would be good, because you want to shut down thyroid production in hyperthyroidism. So there's so many things that enter, you really need to know. And unfortunately, so many patients just buy over the counter or on the internet, and it's just impossible to be able to help them all and help them navigate through.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think of a couple of things, and one is that so much of what I do, like, and I kind of learned about, like, sort of the conversation we're having in mast cell activation syndrome in the summit and today with you, is comes through the world of Lyme and tick-borne illness. And I hear myself saying all the time, it's low and slow and long is often better. It's, if I had a choice between really high dose and really long course at a low dose, I'd take the second one.
Most. I'm 100% with you on that.
And that's what we see with mold. That's what we see with mast cells. And so I'm really glad to hear you say that.
Yeah. Mycotoxins are very high on my list. I've got numerous patients who were just horribly affected by exposure to mold and or mycotoxins. And just to be clear for the audience that might not be aware of it, mold, types of mold make different types of mycotoxins, and mycotoxins stick to everything. I wrote a little editorial about mycotoxins and inflammation, and I quoted actually from the Old Testament. So the rabbi, the rabbi said, we're talking about 3,000 years ago, if you find a house that is infected by mold, you tear it down. That's exactly quote by quote. And if someone has been wearing clothes that were exposed to mold, you burn the clothes. They could not have been more right.
Wow.
Don't pay attention to mycotoxins. You know, of course, if you have musty smell and you see, you know, water stain on the walls, you know you got a problem. But the mycotoxins are very difficult to measure in the air, and they stick to carpets, rugs, etc. So on numerous occasions, I had people just leave their homes for 2-3 months if they could.
And they feel so
many
much
of the
better.
Symptoms got so much better. And we don't have good ways to measure mycotoxins. We tend to measure mycotoxins in the urine, but you know, I've sent urine in 4 different labs and I get, you know, 4 different results back. Okay? And someone would argue some mycotoxins, like ochratoxin, is found also in food sources. So I always say, you know, wash, if you don't want to peel the fruit, wash it with a little bit of soap first. You've got to get the mycotoxins out, no matter where they come from. But you have to address them.
It's so important, because, and it's like this, taking out a little bit of toxin over time, doing the duration, and kind of getting the understanding that we don't need to do everything all at once, I think, too. I mean, except maybe the long-haul COVID lady who's going to get a lung transplant. You kind of have to sometimes, some people throw the kitchen sink. One of the things I did want to highlight, though, that I kind of heard you sort of saying is there's maybe directly saying there is a quality of product in, you know, medication and supplement and the sourcing. So I know that a lot of us have spent a lot of time getting different supplements, different places. The protocols get bigger, they get costly, but please, like, remember to work with your practitioners to make sure that you're, when you're spending money on something that maybe your insurance isn't covering, get the good stuff rather than, because otherwise you're going to be doing this for a little while. And if you're using lower quality stuff, you can actually be making your symptoms worse, not better.
Correct. We're actually, so, you know, the company Algonaut has made, you know, a number of the supplements that we've been talking about. And it is actually on the health store as well. So where many physicians have their own kind of, you know, mm-hmm. store. And I'm writing actually an article with one of the functional medicine physicians who's responsible in the Mayo Clinic. So we're trying to get out there. And it doesn't matter whether someone, in my mind, uses the term integrated medicine or functional medicine, as long as they look for the reasons why. So functional medicine should not be necessarily that we should not be using medicine, or we should not be actually looking for the science. You know, functional medicine, in my mind, or integrated medicine, is to look at the whole puzzle and not necessarily just a piece of the puzzle. But if for each piece or as many pieces of the puzzle, we can find a reason, that's how we should be making our selections, you know, moving forward. And in fact, I wrote a little editorial called Luteolin Supplements, All the Glitters is Not Gold type of thing. And I compared all the luteolin supplements in the United States that were available, you know, 2 years ago when I wrote it. And you'll be surprised. There'll be, for instance, one particular company says 100 milligrams luteolin, but then when you read down, only 10% of that is luteolin, the rest is rutin. And I'll say a word about rutin. There's another one that says 25 milligrams luteolin, which is, you know, a drop in the bucket. And then you read that it's actually two capsules for even the 25 milligrams.
Oh my goodness.
But the word luteolin shows up with big letters, and you've got to read small letters to see that it's not enough luteolin there. So the important thing is that quercetin in life, in nature, exists with a sugar attached to it, and that's rutin. So rutin is quercetin glycoside. So when someone buys quercetin, they've removed the sugar. Now, why is that important? I use rutin too whenever I have GI problems, because rutin will be cleaved by GI bioflora and liberate quercetin in the gut. So it's liberated slower. So mm-hmm. for instance, in Neuroprotec, there's 100 milligrams luteolin, but 80 milligrams quercetin, or 70 milligrams and 30 milligrams rutin, because I'm trying to catch the gut, the rest of the body, and the brain.
Brain.
So, but if you're going to have 100 milligrams rutin, it's not going to help you. It will all stay in the gut. So that's why I'm not saying rutin is bad. Sometimes I use the word inactive, because if you take human cells in culture and you add rutin, it will mm-hmm. not inhibit them, because the cells don't have the way to cleave the sugar. So it, you know, sometimes when the words are used, you know, the mind is faster than your mouth, so to speak, in terms of what you're trying to explain. The bottom line is, I really believe we have good substances out there, and if they can be put into better formulations, we can be doing wonders. I've been trying for 3 years to create an intranasal with luteolin. I haven't been able to find funding, whether it's NIH or corporate America, because there are no patents on it. So
interesting. Yeah, it's one of those things. I think it's so, just everything you've shared with us today is just so inspiring, because there is hope. And I think that so many of us feel that there may not be hope, but, you know, and this is another reason too, like, I really recommend people find a practitioner. If you're having symptoms like this, don't go it alone. There are people who know what they're doing. And like, even like, I mean, I know that like many of the guests, including you on our summit, as well as our, you know, our host, Beth O'Hara, like, I love, she wanted to bring this whole group of people together, because like you just said so eloquently, functional medicine is bringing science to all of this. It's not, it's, and the way the body functions, not so much like no Western medicine or, and all herbs and supplements, or just mm-hmm. meditate in a cave and you'll be better, but it's the bringing together of all these things. So mm-hmm. highlighting all that, I would, you know, I'm just so thankful for the time to talk. And as we kind of land and bring all this together, are there any kind of closing words of hope you want to share with? I mean, I feel like the whole thing's just been this amazing, like, masterclass. And then also, I feel so, as a provider, sometimes I do feel like my patients are losing hope, and I might. So thank you for bringing that back for us.
Three parting comments of you is, number one, there's absolute hope. There's always hope. And if we don't have hope, then we're stressed out and then we're spinning our wheels. Number two, as you said, find the right person. And if that person is not the best person, at least open the door that that person might talk to someone else who might know a little more. And I tend to think that functional integrated medicine colleagues are a little more open to talking to other colleagues than not. The third, probably the most important thing is, in 40 years in research, I've never been funded by NIH to study the mast cell. I've always been funded through, you know, eczema, through psoriasis, through autism, et cetera. There's got to be a request for applications for just studying the mast cell at this point. It's way, way overdue. And in that vein, I've been fascinated, not necessarily pleasantly, by the fact that patients who did very well, who before they got well were saying, my God, I'll give you anything to make me feel better. And I've never asked for money other than give some money for research, they just disappear. There's got to be some money to help, not necessarily me, whoever is out there struggling to find answers. Without money, there cannot be any research. So I'm begging people that are on the way to recovery, or those who are begging for recovery, who might be independently wealthy, we need donations, tax deductible donations to the universities to help out with this research. I mean, we're lacking, we used to be many more in the area of mast cells. I could have counted 20, maybe, colleagues. Now we're down to about 7 who know about mast cells, and 3 of them are retiring. So, and we don't have younger people coming into this because there isn't money into this. These are complicated patients. They require a lot of time. You know, insurance companies don't cover many of these things. So we've got to find a better way to address the patients and do the research that eventually will help everybody. So,
well, a great call to action for everyone. And if maybe you don't fit into that, you know, into the ability to personally fund anything, one of the other things we've seen in the Lyme world is that public talking to their, you know, to the representatives and to the their local governments and those folks who are representing them in Washington does make a change. And there are some changes that have gone on in the last couple of years that have really made a difference. And so if we can dovetail onto the new work that's been going on with Lyme and all these other parts, I mean, the mast cell seems like something that should be studied. So if you happen to think about it, just write to your congressperson or representative as well. And if you know anyone. So Dr. Theoretis, I mean, my goodness, thank you so much. You're so generous with your time and your knowledge.
Thank you.
And thank you all you've done over the past like 4+ decades to help all our patients get well.
Good luck to you and all of you listening out there.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So everyone, thank you again for joining us for this episode of the Reversing Mast Cell Activation Syndrome and Histamine Intolerance Syndrome and our summit, I should say. And my name is Dr. Tom Moorcroft, and we'll see you in our next episode.